Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Good morning. I am so excited to have Fran Rabinowitz back on the show with us this morning. Fran, thank you for being here. Good morning.
Of course. I'm happy to be there, Melissa.
So Fran, for anyone who doesn't know, is the executive director of Connecticut's Association of Public School Superintendents. And I reached out to you, Fran, because, well, you're one of my education experts. I love to get your perspective on things. And one of the things that we kind of came across on the show, actually, we were looking at Disability Employment Awareness Month, which is October. And in talking about it, there were a couple of topics that actually kind of came up on the show, one of which is we were talking about No Child Left Behind. And I understand the concept of No Child Left Behind, especially if you're somebody who's on the spectrum or maybe you're someone with a disability. My first question is, with that, do we feel like that program has to change? Is working? Is it holding, you know, people on the spectrum back post-graduation in any ways? What are sort of your thoughts on it?
Well, thank you for asking. Number one, the No Child Left Behind program was certainly a program under President George Bush. It was the early 2000s, so that program has phased out. But many of the concepts from the program and the mandates remain, and that is, you know, you're going to educate every child, and I think, which is, of course, something that we must do and should do. I do think there are some remnants from that program that aren't the greatest in the world. You know, that program centered us on test scores only, centered us on achievement. We have grown immensely since then to understand that we have to educate the whole child, and that is every child. And no matter where that child comes to us, we have a responsibility to ensure to the best of our ability that that child will be successful in the world.
So, Fran, when you talk about, like, my day when I was growing up in the 90s, you know, my brother, for example, who was autistic, you know, was very much right in the heart of the No Child Left Behind. So it felt like he was kind of being pushed along and, you know, hey, it's fine. He passed, so we're good. And I felt like a lot of the things he missed out on was kind of just to keep up with the norm or to make the school, if you will, the district look good. And I feel like now as he's reaching his 30s, you're seeing that effect. And what I mean by that is something as simple as, sure, somehow he passed algebra. I'm not really sure how he did that because really he's on like a sixth grade level even at 28 years old. But he can't make change out of a $20 bill, if you see what I'm saying. Like,
I agree with you. And I think we have to, it's a huge, complex issue, but I'd like to offer just some perspectives on
please.
It. Number one, we as the public schools of Connecticut and of this nation have a responsibility to every child and to ensure their success. We have a responsibility to adapt that curriculum to meet the needs of every child. It is not okay to say that a severely disabled child who may have a sixth grade level mathematics is not okay. I mean, that's fine. But that child needs to have the life skills that are necessary for him to be successful. Mm. So, you know, in my book, that means managing a checkbook, managing online with your savings and so on, and certainly knowing the exchanges for money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are the kinds of life skills that we must teach our children in order for them to be successful.
I'm so glad you brought those examples up. Fran Rabinowitz, who's the executive director of the Connecticut Association of Public School Superintendents. The reason I'm glad you brought that up, Fran, was because that was the other topic that kind of came up. And I thought, I wonder where we're at with that. Life skills, you know, things like you said, balancing a checkbook or how to, you know, handle your taxes or even, you know, why you shouldn't take out 6 credit cards once you get to college. You know, some of these things or even like home ec classes. I remember when that was being debated. Should we keep it? Should we not? And I thought, yeah, kids should know how to cook. They should know how to do these things.
Well, I mean, I do believe that all of those life skill classes continue, okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And yes, we did get rid of a lot of family and consumer science, but it's not gone completely. It is in the high school. It's under culinary, but we have a different focus. You know, yes, we're showing them how to do recipes and all of that, but we're also saying, and here's the nutritional values, and here's what you need to know about keeping yourself well. So I think it is essential to continue those life skill mm-hmm. classes. And, you know, I wanted to be able to say something, I hope I can, that is really incredibly important for all students. There are students that are severely impaired. You know, it doesn't sound like your brother is one of those. I mean, he can continue on and in sixth grade, but we have students that are even lower mm-hmm. that need to be serviced until they're 22 years old, and we have a responsibility to a transition program for those kids. And there are amazing things that you can do with them in terms of building their life skills, in building their own self-worth, giving them a certificate of completion of high school, and giving them job coaches and finding jobs in the community for them. And it's a real passion of mine, and I do believe that we have an absolute responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I totally agree, Fran. I know we've run out of time because I know you're very busy.
I know,
but
sorry.
No, please don't be sorry. I would love to continue talking about this at some point when you're available, especially this month. I love, you know, I think you're right. I think these job placements and these opportunities post-graduation, like this is, to me, very important with Disability Employment Awareness Month. So if you have the time sometime this month to come back on, I would love to speak with you.
I will, Melissa, and I'm sorry if I took it in a different place, but
you didn't.
I really wanted to get that in there.
No, you really didn't. That was another element that we talked about as well, was like the opportunities post-graduation, because I think that's where employment sometimes does fall short for people who have a disability. So, no, I appreciate it. And if anything, you just teed us up for our next conversation. So, Fran, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Melissa, anytime.
All
Thanks.
Right, we'll talk again soon.
Well, I don't think the timing of this could have been any better. Krista Carnes is here this morning. Oh my gosh, Krista, what in the world is going on with Facebook? It's just a wild, wild west game out there. Holy moly. Good morning. Thank you for being here, our social media consultant. Your timing is impeccable.
Oh, well, I don't know.
I mean,
let's
back up and start with this weekend when we finally reveal who the whistleblower is about Facebook. First and foremost, give us kind of just like a snapshot of what was revealed in this whistleblower complaint.
Yeah. And, you know, it was textbook whistleblower. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, she was working there and she had been in other tech companies, and she was, and I can't remember exactly what her title was, but she was looking into, you know, content.
She was one of the managerial, she was like, she was high up. It's not like she was just a yutz there. She definitely was important. Yeah.
And her, and her role was to make sure that, like, you know, disinformation, like, she was definitely part of like what we're trying to hope that Facebook can take responsibility
Correct.
For making
yes.
sure that things were, you know, good. And I think she just was floored to realize what they knew about the damage and the, you know, the damage and the danger behind, you know, the operations of Facebook mm-hmm. is the messaging that I got. And she was so floored with, you know, the fact that it wasn't out there, that she took it upon herself to copy all these documents and bring them to the attention of authorities. And I think maybe she's very brave. She went through all the right channels. She made sure this is why we have whistleblower laws. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, like, I think it really sort of speaks to how unregulated big tech is. Mm-hmm. And wherever you believe in regulation, like, internet and even social networks are becoming sort of the internet should be probably a utility, I think, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we put people at a disadvantage if they don't have it.
I agree.
But social media, like, if you're not, you know, we regulate the television industry, we regulate the radio industry, make sure that, you know, only appropriate things are on and people don't swear. And, you know, I mean, it's a moving thing. It changes and grows, you know, with the culture, but there's no regulation on this. And so to learn that they kind of know some of the, you know, the social emotional damage to teen girls down to political upheaval in countries because certain information. And her whole point was, the more we fed people this information, the more they clicked, the more money Facebook made on advertising. So it was in their financial best interest, mm-hmm, to keep it going, and sort of, you know, forget the larger, more sort of more ethical or moral picture of it all. This is a tough issue because, you know, it's a slippery slope, and how much do we regulate? And they still own everything.
Everything. Yeah.
Everything. And we've talked about this before on the show, but, you know, with yesterday's outage, which, I mean, the little conspiracy theory in me,
I got to be honest. Yeah, I was going to say, we're definitely going to get into the outage because I definitely said it's I'm just putting facts out there. I'm just putting timelines out there. OK, no opinion here, nothing here. I'm just saying, how does the woman get on 60 Minutes Sunday night? You got to figure some people may have seen it by the time the Twitter gods saw it and everybody started waking up 9:30, 10 o'clock. People are at the water cooler. Did you hear? Oh, my gosh. And they're like, listen, let's shut this thing down. I mean, to me, I don't know how it can't be suspect that Facebook was like, listen, let's change the headline. Let's have a 6-hour outage. The worst thing that happens is that Zuckerberg loses a few billion dollars, which is nothing to him. And we're going to, you know,
right.
To me, it's way too suspect that, like, Russia shut us down. I mean, and there was nothing hacked. I mean, I don't know if it's, I mean, sure, it's a conspiracy theory because there's nothing in fact just yet, but I'm like, listen, these are facts right here. This is a timeline to me.
Well,
come on.
And you know what? If it was an internal choice on their part to do this for whatever reasons, mm-hmm, and I'm, you know, we could speculate, but let's not, they have the power to turn it off.
Yeah.
Like, because it's theirs.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
So it, and I think, you know, I've been in the influencer space, I follow a lot of people online, and like, there were people who were impacted, you know, anybody that's in social media marketing, anybody that's, you know, small businesses that was running some sort of promotion or things
that
had been planned.
Oh, they were in turmoil yesterday. Yep.
They were in and on the flip side of that, I did read a lot of people being like, God, thank you, know how much time I saved yesterday by not being able to log on? You know, I think, you know, it's sort of like put into perspective how often you're there just like sort of mindlessly refreshing your feeds and things
that. Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting, and I think, you know, we have to do something. I mean, it's this perennial issue, and, you know, I think that she was trying to be responsible into the bigger picture of it all.
I think so,
and
too. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we have held Mark Zuckerberg accountable to this. Like, I think he's been able to get away with a lot.
Here's my concern with everything that has been transpiring since the weekend, okay? So you've got the whistleblower. She reveals all this stuff. And you're like, wow, stuff that we kind of, I want to say, knew, especially from that documentary that's like, oh, my God, this is the stuff we're putting out there online, right? So now we have it in writing. We're like, whoa, here's the proof. They're allowing, you know, hate speech to go on, misinformation about COVID. Like, they're allowing it to happen, and they're cool with it because they're still making money. So, great. The proof is out there. Here's why if you want to call it conspiracy theory, which I'm not here to spread those. I'm only here to spread fact. But to me, it makes sense. This makes sense to me because you said it yourself, Krista. How many people went into panic mode yesterday? Because despite all the facts being out there, if they didn't have their Facebook, if they didn't have their Instagram, if they didn't have their way of either checking what's going on in their feeds, or if you're an influencer and that's your way of doing business, You were in panic mode yesterday. So it didn't matter what the facts were of how evil, if you will, that Facebook is. We need it, right? That was, I felt like, the point. If they did do the outage yesterday, it was like, listen, you need us. So the good outweighs the bad, almost. And that's what scares me about this whole thing. That's what scares me.
And that they, you know, this is why, you know, in the history, and I'm not educated in economics any more than just sort of a regular person, but, you know, this is why when something gets too big and people rely on it, like, this is why we break things up, because it's, you know, whether it's an actual monopoly or not is probably, you know, debatable in terms of terms, but like, they are an advertising network, they sell things. And you know, it was just so pervasive. And like, even the WhatsApp, like, so they own WhatsApp too. And that's a global thing. Like, there are people all over this world,
right,
whose main form of like telephone communication, so to speak, is through WhatsApp. So like, you are cutting off, you know, so are you a utility at that point? Can you be, you know, should you be regulated? Should it be broken up so that there is, you know, boards of directors that are accountable? I mean, I think you have to have some accountability. There's no way that we could have anticipated. I mean, listen, I heard this statistic the other day that from the Wright brothers airplane, if you can picture that in your mind,
right,
to landing on the moon was 66 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in terms of like, progress and innovation and development, like, we just don't know what's coming. So we have to sometimes stop and check on ourselves. And I think we've known that they needed a check for a long time.
I agree.
And I think they have powerful lobbyists and they have all kinds of money. And, you know, that has been, but this is the kind of thing where they have to be held accountable. And good for her for coming forward. And And it was vetted. Like, that's the thing that we have to remember is, you know, they went to the Wall Street Journal. They went to really reputable sources. They went to Congress. Like, so people knew this was happening.
Right.
But it did it in such a systematic way that so they can't just, I mean, there's all kinds of theories that yesterday they were, like, you know, dumping documents inside. You know, I mean, who knows what happened? But, like, Facebook employees couldn't even get in the building.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, are they panicked? Like, so, and even just for the... Even just for the questions that are arising, they have to be. They cannot just. I would imagine that they cannot just say, like, oops.
Right. Like, oh, I can't. You know? Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. I agree with you. We're talking to Krista Carnes this morning, our social media consultant, about all the Facebook stuff going on. I'm just going to call it that because there's a lot going on. But, you know, the other thing that kind of, you know, that I thought of yesterday, because I know we're running out of time, Krista, but what's interesting, too, that broke last week was that Facebook decided, hey, we're going to hold off on Instagram for kids. Now, initially, before all the whistleblower stuff, I thought I'm going to talk to Krista about this because this is a win, I would say, in the short term. Like, they were like, temporary, we're going to hold off on those plans. To me, I think this kills those plans. I think anything that could have come out of this is that clearly there is proof that there are young girls who are depressed, anxiety-riven, suicide rates are up. I mean, there's proof in the pudding right now that this is not good for our kids. So what, you know what I mean? Like, how can you go forward with an Instagram for kids at this point?
Well, and that's what I, so here's like, you know, that's, and I have to think that the executives at Facebook were well aware that this was coming. They did, probably didn't know who, but they knew it
there's
was coming.
There's another theory.
So
like,
whether
did they
were
know?
Trying to get ahead.
Yeah, did they know it was coming?
Yeah,
that's
did
a good
they get
question.
Ahead? I mean, I would think there's probably some, you know, they get flags raised or lawyers call whoever.
Right.
You know, I mean, they may not have known exactly the nature of everything.
But they were like, pull this,
think,
pull it right now. Wow, maybe.
Yeah, so maybe they were trying to get ahead of it. And in the end, like, we just have to remember that these businesses are out to create consumers.
Mm-hmm.
They want to sell products for other people and make money and get you to, I mean, they want to be your marketplace too. They want to take a piece of it. Like, there are good things to be had about all these networks, but if you don't have somebody else watching to make sure that nobody is taking advantage of that in
it's
a nefarious way, I mean, this is bad. So I don't think they're going to go away. I think they're going to recover. I think what it's going to be is that they're not going to be able to just pay lip service to it. I think they're going to actually have to make changes.
Yeah.
And well, they should. And for my kids and your kids and, you know, all of us, I hope they do.
I agree with you. Krista Carnes, our social media consultant. So glad that you're a resource on the morning show. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
All right, Melissa, have a great week.
Thanks, you too. And right now we're in Shelton, where we're checking with Mayor Mark Loretti here on WICC. Good morning, Mayor Loretti. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. How are you today?
Doing just fine, my friend. Thank you so much for asking. So let's first talk about, you and I chatted very briefly yesterday, but in the last couple of days, we've been talking a lot to Stamford. They would like to push back the reevaluation for their city to kind of lessen the burden a little bit on their taxpayers. And it sounds like Shelton is in a very similar boat. What's going on?
Well, next year's reevaluation for us, it gets implemented. You know, over my 30 years, we've never missed reevaluation. I've always felt that it was important to stay current with the trends and the assessment, because it's the fair thing to do. You know, I've listened to this argument for years. You know, I can recall cities like Bridgeport and New Haven, Hartford. They wouldn't implement reevaluation for up to as much as 20 years, because, you know, no one wants to feel the pain of the tax shift. But that's the fair thing cares. And when you do that, you know, you create a better environment. It's a fairer environment, I think.
So you're suggesting what for next year?
Well, look, we're gonna follow through with reevaluation. You know, the trends have changed. Residentials are up, and you know, people should be reflected in this.
Sorry, Mayor Loretti.
Sorry,
I don't mean to interrupt you, Mayor Loretti. I just want to make sure that people can hear you clearly. I think your connection is not great. I'm sorry.
Let me see if I can move and change that.
Sorry about that. Only because I want to make sure people can hear your comments.
Can you hear me now?
I can. Yes, you sound very clear. So you are not going to push back reevaluations, it sounds like.
No, I don't believe in it. I was saying that I've always implemented reevaluation. Whenever there's a shift in values, that should be reflected. It's the fair thing to do. You know, we politicians like to keep the burden with our businesses, because most of our businesses don't vote and residents do. I mean, it's a simple concept. And so, you know, but that's not going to help you attract more businesses to your community. And, you know, quite honestly, if you're handling your finances properly, you adjust the mill rate downward. That should compensate. There should be some offsetting to your increased property value. So we've always done it. We've had a lot of success here in Shelton from a financial standpoint. We've created a tax-stable community that is very consistent and predictable, and one that has brought not only residential growth, but commercial and business growth to our city. So I don't agree with changing the rules just because you think it's going to be unpopular at election time.
Okay. I mean, talking again to Mayor Mark Loretti, so you're saying in regards to, like, Stamford, which they're trying to push it back a year, you know, but, like, Mayor David Martin, he can't run. He was beat out by Caroline Simmons. So, like, what would be his gain in trying to push it back, other than he cares about his residents?
I mean, he had this position before the primary.
Right.
You know,
but
I've been listening to this argument for years and years and years. It's unpopular when there's a tax shift in values have changed with residential voters. It's a common thing. But if you're managing your money properly, you adjust the mill rate down. Our mill rate is going to come way down next year when we set our budget.
How do you do that?
Well, because residential values are going to rise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's everybody knows that Connecticut's on fire. The you know, houses are flying off the shelf. I mean, there's nothing even available in Shelton for sale. Every time it comes on the market, it's gone.
Yeah.
And the values are very inflated. So that's going to, when you increase values, you generate more money. So you'll be able to adjust your mill rate downward to compensate that. Some people will see a little increase. Some people will see no increase. You know, I remember some years doing reevaluation where people's taxes actually went down by a couple $100s.
Hmm. Okay. You know, that's interesting.
You have to understand the dynamics of how this works, and it's money management. And in the big cities, it doesn't behoove them, because the residential taxpayer always gets hit the hardest. So naturally, they're the ones who are complaining, we want to put it off. you shouldn't put it off. It's not a fair thing to do in my mind.
Okay. So Mayor Loretti is not going to be putting off reevaluations in Shelton, and just explained why. So as you talk about bringing businesses in Mayor Loretti, I was very excited, and so were a lot of our listeners, quite frankly, in Shelton when we heard that Fountain Square, the plans seem to be back on. What's the latest with that?
Well, as I've been saying for the last 6 to 8 months when people ask about Fountain Square, is that, you know, who's going to sign a lease and start paying rent if there's uncertainty whether you can open or not? And I think that's really the driving force. You know, it's really about the economics of it. You know, I know that they are mobilizing construction equipment up on the site. There's quite a bit of construction equipment there, and they're going to get started in anticipation that leases will be signed and they'll be able to generate revenue. They'll be able to open.
But why did it sit dormant for so long? Was that because of financial reasons or...?
Well, it's because of the pandemic. First of all, no one can open. There's a lot of businesses that went out because of the pandemic when you can't open it, even with the PPE money. So, you know, these are pre-pandemic, they had several leases signed for a hotel and restaurants and some retail space. All that went away.
Hmm.
You know, the retail market has really changed because of the pandemic. You know, we see what Amazon and UPS are in our neighborhood all day long, every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are shopping online now.
Yeah.
Different
no, and there has been a major shift. There's no question. I think it's just interesting, like when you go not too far away in Ansonia, where it feels like businesses just keep going into Ansonia. Like in Shelton, you know, you and I have talked about how Shelton has become, to me, a very popular place where businesses want to go, residents want to move there, it's affordable. So it's weird to me that Fountain Square seems to be like one of the only places in our listening area that just struggled and couldn't hammer this down. It's a little weird, only because other towns and cities with similar properties like that have been able to fill it during the pandemic.
Well, but it's still in the construction too, and you know, that's the other thing. There was no definite time frame when these things would be ready to be leased.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I do think that they suffered for some cost overruns with the site. It's a big site. There had some challenges there, but, you know, by and large, the site is done.
When is it open for people to lease? Do you know when it'll be opening?
Well, I think they would love to have people lease now.
Okay.
And I think that that's what they're working on right now. But, you know, if you look at a lot of even the newer space, particularly in downtown, you'll see are these new apartment buildings with retail on the first floor. They're still not all completely full. The apartments are full. Residential is full. But the commercial space is not. But it'll backfill itself in time because the demand will be there because of the residential foot traffic that's been generated.
Well, Mayor
so
Mark,
I really have no concern about these spaces being filled.
Well, hopefully we start to see more and more entering into that area. I know, like I said, it's something that a lot of our listeners call about very often. So it's very encouraging. We're excited to see movement there again. And Mayor Loretti, we thank you for the latest on this. We appreciate it.
All right. You have a good week.
Thank you. You too, Mayor Loretti.
Family, relationships, and personal growth. Professional counselor Julius Dudix is here to help.
Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600.
Good morning, Julius. I'm so glad you are here this morning. I know people will hear fear and they'll think, oh, it's October, ghosts, goblins, whatever you're scared of. But we're talking about something a little bit deeper than that this morning. I'm so glad you're here to talk about it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Melissa. Yeah, fear is something that everybody wrestles with. It's normal to feel a certain amount of fear when you face various issues in life or people in life. But fear can paralyze you. And I've seen over the years clients that are just so paralyzed and afraid to move forward in life and stuck because of what they fear. And Amy Morin wrote an article, and she said the top eight of things that hold people back in life are change, fear of change, loneliness, failure, rejection, uncertainty, something bad happening, getting hurt, and fear of being judged or criticized. So we all face those fears, but it's really matters of what we do with them and those normal feelings that come. do they dominate us?
So let me get this straight, Julius. Everything that you just said, other than if you went through something and you are then scared of that experience, for example, let's say you're out walking, a dog bites you, now you are scared of dogs. That's an understandable fear. But what you're saying is most of the things you just mentioned are things that haven't technically happened yet. We're scared of them happening. So do we create a lot of our fears?
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, a lot of times in our brain, we tend to create the thing that we fear the most. And it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Why do we do that? Because I do that every day.
Yeah.
No, I have to be honest with you, Julius. Like, I'm sure you're going to bill me after the show. This is something that I hate this about myself. I fear every single day the day that my husband is not here and the day I get a phone call about something happening to my son, even something like, hey, you know, he got hurt on the playground. Like, those are things that I wake up with every single day. And I don't think I'm alone.
Yeah, no, you're not. And that's a very normal thought. I mean, we all fear to a certain amount our loved ones passing. We all fear that car accident. We all fear our grandchildren, you know, drowning or whatever, or the most horrific thing you could think of.
Yeah,
those
exactly.
Those are normal fears. But the question becomes, do we let those fears dominate us throughout the course of the day? And do we become so fixated on them that they begin to impair our ability to do life in a healthy way? It really boils back to, what do we trust? Because we defeat fear by looking at truth and looking at what we really trust in. And ultimately, we know we can't control COVID. We can't control the day of our passing. We can't control anything. And that's where we have to fall back. As a Christian counselor, I fall back on our trust in God and God's incredible love for us to really give us that ability to do life in a healthy way. I was just reading this morning, Proverbs 29 and verse 25 says, fear of man will prove to be a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord is kept safe. A lot of times people fear man, and it can be a snare. Fear can be a snare that prevents you from just becoming all that God wants you to be. You've got a purpose, and you don't want to be overwhelmed by fear to the point where it thwarts your ability to be all that God wants you to be.
So Julius, Julius Dudix is here, who's our morning show counselor. He is a Christian counselor. And, you know, Julius, for you, for me, I think when you're reminded of that, that God's in control, I think that's something that clicks for me. That makes sense for you. What if we have a listener right now who is not a believer or not of the Christian faith or really of any kind of denomination, just doesn't believe in God? You know, how do you find that peace then, you know, of overcoming fear?
That's a great question. And you know, it's my practice is non-judgmental Christian counseling. So I've counseled Buddhists and I've counseled Hindus and atheists and Muslims over the years, all kinds of people, because I'm called to counsel, not to condemn. And I just listen. And really, you choose to believe in life what you want to believe. That's a choice. But along with that choice comes a consequence. And we make our choices, but we can't choose the consequence of those choices. So to believe in Buddha, for instance, or believe in Muhammad, the consequence of that choice is, hey, I've got to live my life in accordance to what I feel or believe. And then the issue becomes, we're driven by our belief system, and our belief system should really affect how we behave. And if there's no direct correlation there, then, and if you don't believe in anything, you've got to really find it within yourself. In terms of humanism, you've got to find it within yourself to pull yourself up by the bootstraps and focus on positive things. And it's all about, you know, your own internal desire to deal with the fear. For me, I believe it's so much more settling and more peaceful to believe in a God who loves me incredibly and who says in Hebrews, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. I mean, God loves you. And that's a huge, huge overstatement. The people just don't really understand the gravity of that statement. And our job, I think, as people, as humans, is to just allow God to love us. We don't do that. We don't do that well. I don't do that well. Just allowing God to love me.
I think in general, because we are flawed You know, we're born flawed.
Yeah.
We're imperfect. Right. And I think the idea of even thinking anyone would like us because of our blemishes and whatever we've got bringing to the table. I mean, we can't even trust other humans, let alone can we trust something we can't see or hear or feel like we're speaking to. So, no, I mean, it's totally understandable. And you know, and I think this is one of those topics where, as you mentioned, Julius, everyone has a different walk of life. And I think it's something where if you have a specific fear or something that really debilitates you, as I mentioned at the beginning of this, I do wake up with fears, but immediately for myself, in prayer and in listening to like Christian music, for example, during my show, when I'm getting ready for my show, you know, it brings a calmness to me. It recenters me. But if that's something that doesn't work for someone else, how can they contact you to come up with a game plan? Because fear is really something that can hold you back in so many areas of life.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, people live such boring lives and safe lives. They avoid the risk of excitement and the need to really be alive.
Yeah.
Fear can paralyze you, but you're not living life to the fullest.
Exactly.
Now, you can contact me at 203-243-7714, or you can read about me on the BARC website or read about me on Facebook or LinkedIn. But ultimately, we have to build our lives on truth. And I've said that before, and I'll say it time and time again. Believing in truth. Finding truth is the way to defeat fear. What's the truth about it? And quite often we create those fears in our head, and we have to come back to what's the truth? Is my grandchild going to get hurt today? Am I going to get hit by a car? You know, we create these unwarranted fears that paralyze us.
It's so true. It's so true. And we so appreciate you helping us to navigate through this. Julius Dudix, our morning show counselor, appreciate your time again this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa. Thank you for all you do. Have a good day.
You too.